You're listening to the Brilliant Business Moms podcast with Sarah Kornack and Bethann Schwamberger. This is episode 57. Today on the show, we're talking with Melissa Will of the blog Empress of Dirt. This episode is so jam-packed with Pinterest information, you are not going to want to miss it. Melissa believes in heavily researching everything she gets involved in and learning the best practices of those sites. And she has done tons of research on how to get the most bang for your buck on Pinterest. And she shares every bit of that research and her knowledge with you today on this episode. Melissa really knows what she's talking about on Pinterest. And I know you're going to get a lot of useful information that you can apply to your business. So let's get started.
You're listening to the Brilliant Business Moms podcast, practical business advice for startup moms.
Today on the show, we are so excited to welcome Melissa Will. Melissa blogs about organic gardening, garden art, and living debt-free at empressofdirt.net. She was actually on the verge of quitting her blog less than 2 years ago when she discovered a Pinterest hack that revived her blog's traffic and gave her the confidence to keep going. Today, Melissa's blog is thriving with over 96,000 Pinterest followers, 29,000 Facebook fans, and just tons of things going on. Melissa lives in Ontario, Canada with her husband, daughters, and Eli the rabbit. Welcome to the show, Melissa. We are so excited to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here today.
We would love to hear more about your story from your own words about when you started your blog and that verge of quitting moment.
Okay. This goes back a while because I have been online a very long time, since the 1980s when it was just the intranet and not the internet. And I have been doing things online all the way along ever since. How I got started in blogging was when I was pregnant with my youngest daughter, which was in 1998. She's 16 now. I became seriously ill during the pregnancy, and I had always been working outside the home. And I went on maternity leave, and because of the illness, I had had preeclampsia and very serious stroke-like symptoms. And during that maternity leave, I knew I was not getting well enough to return to work. So I had to resign from my job and, for the first time ever, rely on someone else for income, which was my husband. So he took over as the breadwinner, and I became a stay-at-home mom, which was a huge change for us. So during that time, of course, I'm always up to something and always like to make things. So I took up quilt making, and from there, I started hand dyeing my own fabrics for the quilts. And then I got quite obsessed with the fabric dyeing, and I started dyeing so much fabric that I knew I would never be able to make that many quilts from it. So I had to figure out a way to justify what I was doing and perhaps sell the fabrics. So I looked at a lot of options and then decided to try having an online shop, which sounds quite normal now, but was kind of a crazy idea because this was around the year 2000, and there were very few online shops, and lots of them were quite sketchy, and there were a lot of crooks taking people's money and running. So I asked my husband how we would set this up, and he showed me how to do HTML, and we set up this shop. And in those days, all we had was the search engines, and somehow people found me, and I got my very first order days later, and it was for over $700 worth of fabric. So I thought, I have a feeling I'm onto something good here. So that started the shop, and from there, I would get letters from people saying, I really want to order your fabrics, but I need to be sure that you really are who you say you are. And I got so many of these queries that I decided to start using the front page of my shop as a sort of journal where I would share my life as a stay-at-home mom and show people what it was like to run a mail-order business at home while you have little kids around. And I'd also give fabric dyeing tips in case anyone wanted to try dyeing the fabrics themselves. So from there, that developed its own following just as kind of an entertaining journal, and that really built up my customer base because they knew there really was a real person behind the shop. That went on until blogging software became available, and then it was much easier to use blogging software rather than hand coding everything all the time. So then I kind of officially became a blogger on Blogspot as well. That went on for a couple years, where I was mom by day and fabric dyer and business person by night. And I love it when I hear Kat Lee talk about Hello Mornings, because I think I was rocking the evenings at that time. Often I would stay up till 2 or 3 in the morning, testing out new fabric dyeing recipes, filling orders, updating the shop, getting packages ready for the mail, and that kind of thing. I got very little sleep, but it was a very exciting time because when you're home with little kids, you really need to have something that's all your own, where you feel valued and creative in it, and you can really spread your wings. So that went on for several years, and from mail order, it branched out into wholesaling the fabrics, working at craft sales, and teaching the fabric dyeing, which ended up being a real key there, because when I started doing that, I realized it was far more lucrative to actually teach what I was doing than do what I was doing. And that came later. After several years, I got totally burned out by obviously having a schedule like that. And I first put the shop on hiatus, and I continued just blogging. And then eventually I shut the shop down. This is kind of a recurring theme for me, but my last ditch effort there was I thought, well, the way I learned to blog was from a very popular book that I found very hard to understand. So when I was teaching fabric dyeing to other people, I wrote my own book, coded essentially a manual for them that I thought was much easier to follow. So I took that manual and I put it online on another Blogspot site, and that suddenly developed its own following as well. People there started asking me if I could put it in a format that was easier to print. So I turned it into an ebook, which I just put up for sale for a few dollars per copy. And that ebook has continued selling all these years later till this day without me doing anything to promote it. From there, I just continued as a hobby blogger, and I was well aware of success stories that would come up where other people were managing to earn a living blogging, but I could not for the life of me figure out how to get from A to B. Then, around 2012, I happened to find Pat Flynn's podcast, his Smart Passive Income podcast, and it was as if a whole new world opened up. I went and listened to every single episode in his archives at that time, and by the end of all those episodes, I was convinced it was possible for a sincere individual to actually earn a living blogging, and that I was going to give it my best shot and try it. I knew that because I had been doing this all along and nothing had really taken off, that I had to surrender and stop doing what I was doing and let other people advise me on how to get there. So I took a blogging course from the guys who now run Fizzle, and I changed up everything. I switched from Blogspot to WordPress. I got a domain. I paid for hosting. And kicking and screaming, I started paying to have a mailing list, even though I could not believe it would ever benefit me, and I just thought I was burning money at that point. That was in July of 2012. I made all those changes, and things did pick up, and I started having several hundred consistent visitors a day, but it still obviously was not enough to earn a living from. That was when, by Christmas time, I had the big talk with myself and said, well, I don't think you're really cut out for this, kid, so let's just have a nice farewell here and move on to something else, because it would really benefit our family if you did generate some income from what you do. So I decided to just do a summary of what I thought were my best projects I had posted that year. And I made my first collage pin showing the different projects, and I put it on Pinterest, which I had hardly ever used. And then I drafted up a farewell newsletter, and I was very happy to stop campaign for the newsletter, which I intended to do the following month. I thought nothing of this, and then within a couple, it must have been even within 12 hours, I started getting messages in my inbox from people I did not know, and I started seeing subscriptions coming in for the newsletter. And then I looked at my traffic, and I actually thought my site was under a robot attack or something, because there were actually people on it. I could not believe what I was seeing. So I'm looking at it, and I had had things happen over the years where big sites had very occasionally linked to something I had posted. An example would be apartment therapy would pick up on something, and for a few days I'd have this huge amount of traffic, but none of it would translate into people who returned. It was just a flourish that came and left. But this just kept coming in, and I was getting all these new subscriptions and people leaving comments, and it was as if my website suddenly came to life. And I looked at it and I thought, it never even occurred to me to do a collage pin or a roundup of my own material to feature it. And I just scrambled trying to figure out, okay, they're coming now, what do I do? And 2013, I spent that entire year learning from that and trying to make the best use of it and trying to make the site better for people who did arrive like that so they would stay. And I did various things throughout that year to grow, again, following much of the advice from Pat Flynn, including I created an ebook about that pin. So all of the projects in that, all the instructions for how to make those things are in a ebook, which I put for sale on the blog. And the instructions are also available free on the blog, which I make perfectly clear. But it does seem that people really like the convenience of having things in an ebook. I did that. I discovered a website called hometalk.com where you can share any projects you have made and link back to your own site there. So if those get a lot of attention on HomeTalk, a lot of new readers will come from there. I reached out to someone I didn't really know but really admired and started a blog tribe with her to have other garden-related bloggers work together to grow all our blogs together, which has been a huge key in growing things. And then I really hunkered down and tried to be much less inept at social media because I really did not know what I was doing on any of these things and tried to learn the best practices of each one I was using so that at least whatever I shared would have a fighting chance if I was promoting something. The end of 2013, I was definitely earning a full-time income, and things have only grown since then. So that's where I am now.
I love your story, Melissa, and I love the fact that even after you were, you know, taking a blogging course, you were getting advice from some big names, but still at first you still weren't quite seeing that success. But I think that's something that a lot of people fail to realize is there's maybe not a cookie cutter answer for everyone. It is some trial and error, and you finally did, you know, find that thing that worked, that roundup post, and then you turned it into an ebook. So that's just incredible. I love that. Piggybacking off of that, can you share, since then, as you've dug into Pinterest, what are the best tricks you have for other moms who want to get into Pinterest?
Here's what happened for me. My traffic from Pinterest grew like crazy, and by the end of 2013, it was probably 80% of my traffic. And that can be quite wonderful when you're getting tens of thousands of views a day, but it's also quite terrifying to have all your eggs in one basket like that. So I have tried to make the best use of Pinterest, but with the most efficient use of my time. And then I have spent much of this year intentionally trying to spread my traffic sources out to other things such as consistent search engine traffic, and then working on improving my skills in other social media. So I have some tips for absolutely giving you the best chance you have on Pinterest, but also how to make the best use of your time and kind of get two for one value when you're doing things that work for Pinterest. It will also help you promote yourself in other areas. So for starters, just looking at Pinterest, for me, there's three basic goals in mind. One is you want to engage the followers there so that you are getting repins and click-throughs. That's pretty simple, and hopefully they'll follow you on Pinterest. But once they click through, you want them to stay on your site. You want them to take off their coats and stay a while, and that's the thing that is key to really building this up rather than having a huge bounce rate when a pin is really popular. In doing this, for me personally, I earn a full-time income, but I only work half days. So to be able to do work as smartly as possible and know the best practices everywhere means you can truly achieve in 3 hours a day what somebody in an office would do in 7 or 8 hours if you really focus on things. So for Pinterest itself, the number one thing is you've got to keep up with the changes going on there. I think all of us just wish that for all of these sites, things would just stay the same for at least a few months so we could catch our breath and know what to do and just do it. But the reality is that they change things up all the time, and you've got to keep up with whatever they consider to be the best practices at the time, because that is what their algorithm is going to favor. In terms of Pinterest, it means I listen to all sorts of podcasts and I keep up with websites, but often the blog posts that Pinterest puts out, and they also have one their engineers put out, will tell you the very latest things they are trying to do. And there's very strong hints in there about how to be a good player on their site. For example, there was a huge algorithm change back in August, and that completely turned the feed upside down for a lot of people. They have said they want crisp, well-composed images, and they do not want the spammers and scrapers on there the way they have been. So this means, number one, this is not a tip that Pinterest gives because they don't have so much of a vested interest in this, but as a pinner, when you're repinning other people's content, you have to check where that image is linked to and make sure it is either going to the original source or the page it's going has permission to use that image, because if you are repinning stuff without checking these sources, you are essentially working for the spammers. People all the time on there take original content and use it for their own use without giving any proper credit or linking to the sources. And if you want to build up a following as a great pinner, either with your own content and that of other people, you have to be a trusted pinner where people know whatever they click on will take them to that information that they're interested in. Pinterest is kind of interesting on this because their only guideline says make sure your pin links to something helpful. And I just don't think that goes far enough, because if you have ever had one of your own images go viral on Pinterest, that is very exciting. But when you find out that it has been linked to someone else's site with no credit to yours, it is quite heartbreaking. I've had that happen a few times, and I've had it happen to friends where there are virtually hundreds of thousands of repins and it all goes to a spammer's site. So that's a best practice that I suggest just for being someone people really want to follow and trust. And when I know other pinners are like this, I know I can look at their pins and know I can repin without checking because they have always done their homework there. The other thing that Pinterest wants is that you set up your profile properly. These are really basic things. It's just like when you have your own website, you want it to be formatted really nicely where it's really easy for people to get around and find things. You want it to be easy for Google to index you and that kind of thing. And the same thing goes for how you set yourself up or your profile in Pinterest. You want to have a nice profile image, write a good description about what you're doing. If you earn any money from your website, it is in their terms of service that you have to have a business account, which is free. You need to verify the URL of your website, and very importantly, enable rich pins, which there's information right on Pinterest about how you do this. If you have rich pins enabled in whatever format you like, for me, because I do DIY projects, I have it for article pins. That will put you higher in the feed. It's basically a validation system that is showing that your pins really do go back to the original site. You want to have boards that are engaging and tell a story. You need titles and descriptions that will make your boards appear in their search engine. It's just like Google. All we have is words to communicate what is going on in the image. So make sure that you write naturally in an engaging way, but make sure any keywords about the content you are pinning appear in your description there so that your boards will come up when someone looks for that type of board. You want to make sure your boards are linked to the correct category that best describes what they're about. And you have to keep your account active on a regular basis where you pin, like say over the course of a few weeks, make sure you have added pins to all of your boards and that you don't let a bunch of them go dormant. There's definitely rewards in the feed for people who stay active and play nice. Last thing there is you'd want to change up your board covers every so often so there's a new appearance to them. And if you do things that are seasonal, make sure whatever season you're in that those boards are pushed to the top so they're visible to someone coming new to your page. Another thing for best practices is the actual pins themselves. Pin descriptions are a huge opportunity to do better in the feed. The more specific you can be about what the pin is about, the better the search engine can index it. For example, if it's a DIY project, just tell what the project is, perhaps how it was made or what materials were used in making it. This is the kind of thing where if you just give a sentence or two, again, in an engaging and natural style, but make sure the keywords are there. So if somebody wants to make a polka dots with pine cones, that both those words are in there. A trick that a lot of people aren't aware of is the actual file name of your pin is important. It appears very clear that the search uses that file name also to index it. So make sure if we're talking about pine cones that the word pine cone is in the name of the image. The same thing helps you on your own website. You should be naming all of your images with the keywords in the image name so that Google can show it in image searches and that the keyword is in the URL that the image is linked to so that pinecone appears in the image name, pinecone appears in the URL, pinecone is in the description of the pin, and it's probably on a board, something to do with nature crafts or something like that. So you can see how all those things stack up together to make your pin more visible. At your end, it really helps. They're looking at not just those things that you're doing with the quality and control of your pins, but the more people who engage with your pins will also boost it farther. So on your website, you want to make sure you provide high quality images that people can pin, that you use the pin it button, which of course Pinterest prefers you use their pin it button and have that hovering over each image so people can pin from there. We know that tall vertical images do best visually on the page when people are scanning through what they want to repin. So I try to always offer a mixture of, I always have at least one long vertical image or collage as well as other choices. And you have to fill in on your own website the alt tags for images, which is where most pin it buttons pull a description from. So if other people are pinning your content, it is very rare, unless you have a really good blogging friend, that they're going to hit the pin it button and then actually compose a keyword-rich description for that pin. So you've got to make sure your alt tags are filled in there. And so when they click that pin it button, that pin is ready to go. It has a beautiful description that will go into the search engines and they don't have to think about it again. The last thing is there that hashtags have never really taken off on Pinterest, and now they are strongly discouraged, I would say. So the only occasion where you'd ever put a hashtag in a description is if you were doing a sponsored post or something where you have to include a SPON or AD hashtag to identify that it is a sponsored pin. Besides that, their best practices, again, are that you're a regular user, you're engaged, you don't just promote your own content, but you like and comment and share other people's stuff, and that the system sees you're consistently active. So that's quite a bit of detail, but that's just my point number one, is to know best practices. And I try and do the same thing on any social media I use, to know exactly what their system wants so that I make the best use of my time when I'm there and have got all those boxes checked off, so I know at least there's a fighting chance of that pin being seen.
Those are some excellent tips, Melissa, for sure. And I think some you touched on are definitely new to many of our listeners. And I think you're exactly right on the alt tags. A lot of people miss that. Anytime I'm doing a blog post or, you know, podcast episode with show notes, I take advantage of those alt tags and write in, you know, that description I want. Because you're right. People, when they pin, that's what shows up. And so you want it to be right there for them. I am curious about the hashtags because, and maybe I guess I've probably gotten old advice, which was use two hashtags, no more, no less. But is there's new news from Pinterest that says they just really don't prefer hashtags?
Yes, I was looking at the guidelines they have written for the new paid promoted pins that are starting up now. And they said that one hashtag is okay, but any more than that appears to be spammy.
Okay.
And then I saw another article that said that if there is more than one hashtag, the pin is actually demoted in the feed.
Oh, wow. Okay. That is excellent to know then. I need to stop. I've been using two on pretty much everything, so I'll have to change that up. I am curious, too, have you done any promoted pins? Have you experimented with that?
I have not so far, and I'm not sure what's going to happen for that for, you know, little pinners like us as opposed to big brands that will be using it. So I'm just waiting to see right now. Mainly, it's been very helpful because as they do release the guidelines for these, they're giving a lot of information about what they like in pins. So I've mostly been looking at that and trying to make use of it.
Okay, great. And would you say, in terms of where you find the best Pinterest advice, are you just getting most of your information right from the source? You're just going right to the articles and updates that Pinterest releases?
I definitely check there all the time and hear what they're saying. And then I really enjoy listening to Cynthia Sanchez's podcast, Oh So Pinteresting, and I follow social media marketing and all those usual things, because between them, I think everybody seems to pick up on different tips and ideas and test out different things, and it's kind of a combination of all these things that is constantly bringing me to change things up a bit or do things differently as we hear different news.
So, Melissa, you've clearly... You do lots of research in regard to Pinterest, and you are a wealth of information. So for you personally, how much time are you putting into Pinterest each day? What does your Pinterest routine look like?
Here's the really funny part is I probably spend a total of 10 minutes a day on Pinterest. And it sounds funny when you think that from the things I've done, this has resulted in hundreds of thousands of visitors to my site. But I kind of have an approach to it that the time spent on Pinterest is really the least of what serves me on Pinterest. And I have an idea that may help some people to figure out how to make things work better there. The idea I have is to, first of all, when you're creating any content, before you even get started with it, think about your audience, how you're going to present it to your readers, and how you would promote this thing on Pinterest and other social media outlets. I do this before I ever write a post. And a lot of people prepare the content and then they say, okay, now what am I going to use for a pin? And I would say, flip that on its head and start with, okay, I have this idea. Let's develop it with sharing it in mind. And what I do is for example, if I'm doing a project I want to put on my blog, I basically write out a little storyboard of all the images I would like to have in the post, including ones I think would do well on Pinterest, on Facebook, on Google+, on Twitter, Instagram. And I make sure while I'm working that I take all of those images so I have them. And I find that since I've been doing that, my work time has gone down a lot because I'm not reinventing the wheel each time I want to promote something somewhere. But I've got basically everything available to me when I'm ready. Connected to this, I really encourage people to build up their own image libraries. And what I do is I always have a camera with me, and no matter what I'm doing, I take lots of photos. If something is interesting or beautiful or tells a story or just looks like it would be a beautiful background for something, I snap the picture. I try and use natural light all the time, and I might snap a close-up, I might take a picture far away, and I also always shoot little video clips of stuff. And what I found is over time, this has built up a huge resource for me so that at any time of year, I can blog about any subject I want and not have to worry about getting the images for it. And I have the added bonus to know that they are my original images. I have full rights to use them and can do whatever I want with them. The other part of that is if you get in the habit of collecting all these photos, at some point, if you either get an offer to do a book or you want to prepare your own ebook, you've got a huge amount of content that your readers have never seen that you can use in the book without having to shoot it all over again. I take the images every day or every few days. I keep them on an external hard drive, and then I come up into a cloud and just dive in whenever I want to write something. Every so often I go in and tag a bunch of the images so I can find them easily, and it's been a really good resource for having that library.
That's great advice, and that's a really interesting perspective too, to just, you know, always be ready, and it's great to hone your skills as well as build up your library. I'm curious to know if your roundup posts, which I know, you know, one of your roundup posts was kind of what revived your blog and went viral on Pinterest. Are those still your most popular pins, or is there something else that wins out?
Those are, and I'll tell you, here's the interesting thing, because there's been a lot of discussion ever since Pinterest said, with this algorithm change that came out in August, and they said, we want quality pins. And that opened up discussion, okay, what is a quality pin? Because obviously they want it to be something probably that's a nice quality photo and beautiful, but it has to have the engagement on it to be of value on Pinterest. So that led to the discussion of whether should images have text overlays on them or not. And there's purists who just want plain, beautiful photos without any words on them, and other people who always put words on them, and I kind of go in between the two. And that connects to the roundups, because often I'm putting several images from different posts in a collage, and I'm going to put some sort of title on it to tell what that thing is about. And what I think is the smartest idea is to pay a lot of attention to how your images look on mobile devices, because from what I've read, people on Pinterest, it's got to be between 70 and 80% of their viewers are looking at the images on a phone. So if a text overlay has too much clutter on it and it's hard to read, it's probably not going to do well on a mobile device. But if it's fairly simple, what wording's on there, and it's easy to read, it's probably going to do better. for me, of all the pins since that first one that went viral that I've had do really well, which can be in tens of thousands of repins and probably some of them over 100,000 repins, every single one of them has been a collage. And I know that is contrary to what some other people experience, but that has been so lucrative for me that I have gone ahead and over the course of a year, I will write a whole bunch of posts that have some uniting theme to them. And then I'll do a roundup post that features all of them together in that collage and pin that. That is a great way to repurpose old content and bring new traffic to it. Those always do well. As well as I make collages for various menu pages on my site. So, for example, at the top of my site, it says Garden Ideas, and when you go there, there will be a not just a list of all of my posts that are about garden ideas, but there will be a pinnable collage with images from several of those posts that people do pin on Pinterest. And that will bring a whole bunch of traffic just to my menu pages, which from there people explore all sorts of content. And those two have been huge traffic drivers and ways to get people not just on my site, but really staying for a long time. For those menu page collages, I find people stay 4 or 5 minutes on the site, as opposed to perhaps with another pin, it might be that they're there a minute or two, so they're really significant.
You have a couple income sources, Melissa. You have your website, which has ads and affiliate links, and you also have a couple ebooks. Do you still sell your fabric dyeing ebook?
I do, and this has been something I have wrestled with for years because I would have always been uncomfortable about selling or being overt about sales. I do not like overt salespeople. I don't want to be one of those. And here's a big lesson I learned over the years was the quote I found that best encompasses it is the advice to serve, don't sell. And for I've always liked to be helpful for people. I've always been open about sharing information. I love to help other bloggers and learn from them and exchange ideas. And in doing all that, For so long I was afraid to come across as a salesperson, and I did not want to do anything in that realm. But I realized by shying away from selling things, I was also withholding valuable resources that people actually want to know about. And it took me until I heard that quote, the light bulb went off, and I realized when you're writing a blog post and you're talking about how you make something, of course show people exactly what materials you like to use and give examples on whatever website you can link to that shows those materials. Whether they choose to buy it or not is entirely their business, but you are giving them a huge helping hand if you can show them exactly what you like to use and why, and what things didn't work and why. And it's the same thing with my ebooks. They've always come out of a request from people because they just simply want an easier way to get the information. So I've never done anything like have affiliate sales or anything simply because I didn't think that the ebooks I've done so far were strong enough that way to ask other people to promote them. But I have had them up on my site available for several years now, and they still sell thousands of copies a year without me doing anything other than having them physically available there.
Wow. So with those various income sources, what's a breakdown of where what percentages of income come from which sources every month?
My biggest income source is AdSense, and here's something I learned along the way, which was a major facepalm. The way you set up AdSense can change everything. I hear so many people saying they cannot get any traction with it. And at one point, I got the advice that there were two key things you have to do there. You have to set up your ads as targeted. And the information is right there in AdSense. And you're basically just filling in little descriptions about your site, who you're, what it's about, what you blog about, who your audience is, where on your site the ads will appear. Between the targeting and then the physical placement of where the ad is huge. The third thing that's come up in about the last half year is that AdSense now has mobile responsive ads. And when I switched to those, that was the final thing that just made it take off. Because if your sites are like mine, I think I have now about 65 or 70% of my traffic is on mobile devices. And if your ads aren't mobile responsive, they're cutting off in the view, and people do not like to look at or touch an ad that is cut off. If it is mobile responsive and they can see the whole thing on their screen, they're much more likely to engage with it. So those were the three things that made AdSense work for me. When I talk about the placement of the ad, contrary to all the advice I had heard, I experimented with placing one square ad in the upper third of every blog post I have. And I use a plugin called Quick AdSense that lets me place it exactly where I want to fall in the blog post, which is generally under the first image I have in there. When I made that change, my AdSense shot up incredibly. And it was kind of funny because I actually got a phone call from Google saying, "You are doing so well with your AdSense now. Would you like a private consultation with a specialist here to discuss how you're doing it and then see if they have any further suggestions for you?" So that was quite amazing. And it made me crazy because at that point when I made these changes, my content had been exactly the same for months before, earning a tenth of what I started earning after I made those changes. So that was huge. So AdSense is the primary one, and then I show products on Amazon only when it's relevant in a post. And anybody who's a longtime reader knows I'm so obsessed with being frugal and taking care of your family and your future first that I never want people to buy anything that they can either get by some other legal and ethical source, since we all have so much unused stuff sitting in our houses at any time. I'm sure someone has that stuff they'd like to lend to someone or give them. And then I have the ebooks for sale, and then every so often I have sponsors come in who want to either have a sidebar ad for a while, and very, very rarely I do sponsored posts. I think I've only done a few. I probably say yes to one of every 100 I'm approached about, just because there's something about doing them that gives me the heebie-jeebies.
Thank you so much for sharing that advice on Google AdSense, because you're right. I think a lot of people think, oh, you'll never make money with that. But clearly, you are doing very well with Google AdSense. So that's amazing.
It's always about whatever thing you're using, you know, whether it's Pinterest or Twitter or Facebook, it's AdSense or some other ad network. Find out everything you can about the best way to use it and set it up, and follow that meticulously so that you give yourself the best possible chance to do as well as you can. I tell you, the number of things I ignored over time where when I started doing it, I just could not believe the difference it made. And I just had to say, well, at least you've smartened up now, Chickie. But wow, that took a long time.
Well, we're so glad that you have dug into all of these things and are so meticulous now and are doing so well. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today, Melissa. We have learned a ton. I know our show notes of this episode are just going to be filled with all of these incredible tips that our listeners can take action on. But as we wrap up today, do you have either a funny or, well, I don't know how old your daughters are. If they're on the older side, maybe not an adorable mom moment these days, but...
When one of my daughters was in preschool, I would have to take her every day at an early hour to her program, and we would often be rushed, so I would make her toast for breakfast, and we'd be in such a hurry that I'd bring it and she could eat it in the car on the way to her preschool. So we lived somewhere where there was a very fast road with a sharp bend in the road. And every day we'd set out and whiz around this corner and off we'd go. And there was a particular day where we're going around that turn and I see this thing fly past the car. And I couldn't tell what it was, but it startled me. And I was trying to look in the rearview mirror and I couldn't tell what it was. And I just carried on our way. And then the same thing happened the next day. I get her in her car seat. Thing whizzes past. The only thing I could think it looked like was like a clay pigeon or something. And I thought, is somebody really like hiding in the woods there, throwing something at the cars? I just couldn't believe it. So the third day, I'm on the lookout and we go around that bend and I see it again. And right then my daughter says, Mommy, yes, dear, I think my toast just flew past the car. I realized that. Each day I was putting the plate of toast on the roof of the car while I hooked her into her car seat and forgetting about it. That was her toast.
That's too funny.
Flying past the windshield. I thought, what a good kid. She just drank her juice and never mentioned that she didn't have breakfast all those days. Off we went. I thought that's a perfect example of when you have your mind on too many things at once. And I do tend towards that, but I do try and focus on my kids when I'm with my kids and keep work separate now.
That was a great story. Could you tell all of our listeners where they can find you, all of your relevant accounts on Pinterest or Facebook and your website?
The easiest thing is to come to my website at empressofdirt.net, and from there the links are there to everything I'm engaged in.
Great. Well, thanks again. This was certainly an information-packed episode, which is what we like, so thank you.
Thank you for having me. I hope it's helpful for others.
Definitely.
I told you that was going to be an information-packed episode. If you weren't taking notes, do not fear. Just head on over to brilliantbusinessmoms.com/57 for the very thorough show notes on this episode. I have a feeling that if each of us just took one piece of that Pinterest advice that Melissa gave us, that it would do wonders for our Pinterest engagement and repins and click-throughs. Now it's your turn to head out there and be brilliant.